From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
This morning we speak first with Immaculata DeVivo. She is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and professor of epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. She writes about the biology of kindness. It's 6 daily choices for health, well-being, and longevity.
Then we speak with Joshua Glenn. He has collected science fiction stories and books from 1900 and 1935 and has preserved these forgotten classics in a new series called The Radium Age. You discover the origins of the enduring tropes like berserk robots, tyrannical supermen, and dystopian wastelands. It's a fascinating series.
Yes, it is. If you're a science fiction lover, aficionado, then make sure you tune in and stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Well, the science is in. Being good is actually good for you. The science of mindfulness and the findings of biology come together to show how kindness and optimism improve overall well-being in profound, organic, and demonstrable ways. Our next guest is Immaculata DeVivo. She is a preeminent researcher in molecular epidemiology at Harvard University, who, along with Daniel Lumera, who's an expert in meditation and mindfulness, outline a revolutionary approach to health, longevity, and quality of life. And they explain all this scientific evidence that supports their work in their new book. It's called The Biology of Kindness. Immaculata, welcome to Cool Science Radio. Now, Immaculata, you teach a course in molecular biology. Now, how does that eventually make its way into the biology of kindness, seemingly a more ethereal concept?
Well, that's such a great question, because in teaching this class that I've been teaching at Harvard now since 1999, which is really the nuts and bolts of molecular biology, you realize that diverse behavioral practices and lifestyles like meditation or exercise ultimately are acting through biology and not some supernatural ether of some sort. And in teaching this class, and specifically the topic of telomeres, which are the DNA bits at the end of your chromosomes, which over the last, I would have to say, 10, 15 years, have captured the imagination, not just scientists, but the public. These little bits of DNA are considered a clock, a biological clock, ticking away. They measure the longevity of your cell, right? And by extension, the longevity and health of a person. So this idea that these bits of DNA can be impacted, right, by lifestyle, which we know, and the lifestyle that people really know, they know most is physical activity and diet. But in my experience working at Harvard with collaborators and being brought into these incredible research projects with psychiatrists, and studying meditation and post-traumatic stress and depression and optimism, where I was always asked, you know, Immaculata, you know, we really need a biological handle. You know, we know that these behaviors, pro-social behaviors, these interventions, they impact health. They impact quality of life. But we need a way to objectively show people that. Just sort of like, show me the money, you know? And I said, well, we can try to address that question. We have this biological measurement of bits of DNA that can reflect your aging, your cellular aging, and by extension, again, overall aging. And so that's how I was brought into a lot of these, what I call adventures, with this really open-minded attitude of trying to put that biological handle on these interventions, pro-social behaviors. And in the process, I've made many very good friends. They're often mentioned in the chapters. So the two are not, they're related. They feed each other.
Yeah, they are very related. And I find it really interesting. And this is what we need. I mean, we've known for a long time that things like mindfulness and meditation are good for you. But for many of us, we need the science behind it. And I hear a lot of people dismissing these things as, oh, that's kind of new agey, not for me. And so for those of us who do need the research behind it and we do want that scientific proof, enter you, Immaculata de Vivo. And I just think it's a really wonderful thing. Let's go back into the science a little bit more about, I've heard over the years in hosting this show, talk from time to time about telomeres. Did I say that right? Telomeres, right?
Yes, you did.
And can you talk a little bit more about what that is, when it was discovered, and how they are affected? Like, how can you do the research to show how they're affected by things like kindness?
Okay, so these are all terrific questions. So in the most ecumenical way that I can describe them are they're the plastic bits in your shoelaces. This is what they're equivalent to. This is not my analogy. It's been used by many scientists. So
It's a
essentially,
good one. It's a good one.
yeah, it's a very discreet, you immediately, there's still shoelaces out there. So if you look at a shoelace, the little plastic bits, what are they there for? To keep the shoelaces from fraying. And that's what your telomeres. So they are repetitive bits of DNA that protect the ends of your chromosome. And they're there to eventually, over time, normally, they get shorter and shorter with age. Okay. And that's just, I'm not going to go into technical aspects of the process, but just to know that most cells undergo this. And this is a way to protect the cell long term from cancer. So the idea is that scientists are interested in telomeres. I got interested from a cancer perspective because I specifically study cancer. But I realized in working with a variety of these colleagues and scientists who I mentioned that it was so much more because by so the idea is that accelerated shortening is not okay. Because accelerated shortening of these telomeres bring chronic disease like cardiovascular diseases closer in early age. So, there's this idea of chronological age and biological age. Chronological age is your calendar years, right? So we know that, and I know from my own work studying centenarians, where by the calendar, some of the people that we've studied, these long-lived people, are 103 years old. But when we look under the hood and measure the telomeres, okay, they have the biological age of a 70-year-old. And so the papers are published. So this idea is that the reason these perky 100-plus people are perky is because their biology is really 70. So they're acting more like, biologic. So they were discovered a long time ago, telomeres, okay? This idea that telomeres existed, the ends of your chromosomes, very long time ago, 1940s, early 50s, it became very famous. Telomeres and the enzyme that regulates telomeres, telomerase, when my good colleague Elizabeth Blackburn and her and Carol Greeter and Jack Sostak were given the Nobel Prize a few years ago for identifying the enzyme, okay, that maintains telomeres. And she, Elizabeth Blackburn, published a very important paper many years ago on how stress impacts telomeres. I want to say 2003 or 2004. That really, in my view, blew it all open to actually study these bits of DNA in this regard. So they were always there, okay? They became even more famous. But then what drove the research is technology. Okay, so as always the case, innovation technology drives it forward. Okay, so there was a cumbersome way to measure telomeres. Cumbersome in many ways, technically, biospecimen like DNA and resources, until there was a method, a very quick, high throughput method that came about so that we could actually study many, 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 many people at once with tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of DNA. That just turned the whole field around because to do this kind of research that is illustrated. Demonstrated in the book, which is on a population level. Okay. Statistics are your friends. You know, you need to look at a lot of people to ask these questions. And you need to have a contrast. So if you're looking at meditators, like we did in the loving kindness paper that's in the book, now we looked at telomeres, but there's also brain scans, right? There was a preponderance of evidence, as we like to say. We looked at women who were long-term meditators versus women who were not long-term meditators. And the outcome in that paper was depression. And again, I was approached by Elizabeth Hoagie, who wrote a beautiful blurb on the book, unbeknownst to me, just a brilliant psychiatrist who had also had some training in mindfulness. And she had approached me and said, Immaculata, you publish all this really cool stuff on telomeres. Would you like to work with me on this? And I said, sure. You know, again, we ask the questions. We don't
Right.
know the answers until we ask the questions.
But if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are having a conversation with Immaculata DeVivo. She is one of the co-authors of the new book, The Biology of Kindness: Six Daily Choices for Health, Well-being, and Longevity. Well, Immaculata, tell us your definition of kindness. I know it goes beyond just being pleasant to someone on the street. What is a scientific definition of kindness?
That's a great, you know, great question. And this is something, again, of major contributions from the conversations Daniel and I had. You know, there's the kindness to yourself, to others, acts of kindness, graciousness, care, right? Self-care, outer care, inner care. So the reason I had come up with this title, or it was, again, it was a talk in Italy, so I wanted it to be a bit more punchy, and it was a diverse audience. But this idea that we were using kindness as a catch-all way to emphasize the research related to pro-social behaviors, right? And how it's not just good for you morally, but also for your DNA, right? It's good for you in a biological sense. So if you can't do certain good acts because your morals won't let you, can you please just do it because it's going to make you live a little healthier and possibly a little longer? So that's the way, it was a very literary title for a trade book that was my first, you know, entry into this world. And yes, so that the kindness, of course, I was using the definition that we've all been taught. But it was really a way to capture the pro-social behaviors that we talk about in the book, the optimism, the happiness, the importance of relationships.
So in the book, there you talk about the strategies of being more kind, which includes, you know, being kind to yourself, being kind to others, being kind to animals, being kind to plants. We all in this town in Park City, we're very active. So I think we really understand the effects of physical activity because everyone's happier after a day of skiing or being on a mountain bike. But talk to me about music. There's a section in the book about how you can use music as a strategy for kindness. That fascinates me because I always have music on. It definitely affects my mood. So tell us about music.
I'm so glad you brought that up. So, of course, right, we all have our personal experience with music, right? I mean, of course, we all know there's happy music and there's, you know, sad music, but in overall, it has an impact on your moods, right? So, I will say that the music chapter, I got a lot of inspiration from a neighbor of mine who is mentioned in the book, who actually studies the impact using music for his, to help rehabilitate stroke patients. And I was amazed. And I would have these conversations with him over dinner, and he would say, different parts of your brain are activated in response to language, in response to different type of music. And so in this conversation, where music therapy is used for cardiovascular patients, for stroke patients. He talks of a patient who could not speak a word, but could sing. And so that intrigued me. And clearly, there's the kindness, the health benefits. Again, if we outfocus the word, right? And not so, it's the health benefits of music, right? And so then in doing, it lowers pain. And then we found through research, through Daniel and myself, we found that there's certain Mozart or Bach that impacts in different measures, will impact your blood pressure, your heart rate. So clearly, music, something that is, not considered biological at all, clearly has biological impact. And that is the theme of this book, the awareness that walks through nature, being for forgiveness, they just really, they have an impact on your biology. And so that is, if I had to, the contribution in my contribution, I'd have to say in this book is that we show the molecular link, at the DNA level, that these sort of interventions, lifestyle, behavioral interventions, are impacting your DNA, the bits of the DNA that are changeable, right? Because that's one thing I forgot to mention. For the most part, your DNA is not changeable. It's immutable. But the epigenome, and I don't, this word that's thrown out, those bits of the DNA are modifiable. And we're finding that through this research that, telomeres are having an impact. Life experience is shaping our telomeres.
So, Immaculata, I'm wondering, and I hope our listeners are wondering this too, that as Katie said, it's not just enough to be kind, say kind things to people. It's about maybe acts. That concept of paying it forward is an important one. But how do we become kind at our very core if it's, I mean, hopefully we've all come into this world unless we're psychopaths with a natural ability to be kind. But how do we coax it along a little better?
Sure. So Daniel has a really great strategies for that in his sections. But basically, we did do this concept of paying it forward with a book. In Italy, for instance, bookstores, coffee shops that were selling the book, we did a paying it forward. You buy two books, one book was left behind for someone else. So because we really wanted to spread the concept of that is in this book. So one great way that research shows is through acts of volunteering. And this is minimal. This is not just, you don't have to hop on a plane and, work. I mean, that's great too, but small acts of kindness. Your neighbor bringing out the trash, small things, even complimenting the cashier. Thank you for, thank you for your service today. Or you really would be surprised at these little small gestures, we call them, the research is there, changes the dynamic of not just you, but that other person, because they're valued, they're validated, they're seen, they're understood, it's really what you learn is that it doesn't take a lot to do these bits for other people. I know what you're saying, that it seems like a Herculean task, but the small things actually go a long way. And also something I learned from Daniel is that in order to be kind to other people, you really have to be kind to yourself. And I sort of had this like, what is he saying? And I get it. Over time, I'm starting to get it, because when you're kind to yourself, you blame yourself less, you're less judgmental. And that allows you to be, see people in that way too. And there's this saying that a lot of people have said, that, you don't know what people are going through. And so you really should assume kindness on them because we're all people walking around with stuff. Should.
That reminds me of, this was years ago, but I was pulling into the children's hospital with my son. And you know when we've all had this happen where there are hardly any parking spots left, and someone has straddled the line and taken two spots, and the things that run through your head about that person. And I just distinctly remember, for some reason, probably because we were at the children's hospital, I said to myself, you know, maybe that person pulled in there, their child is sick, they're coming in for a chemo treatment, and they were in a hurry and they just parked that way. And that is what I think every single time now when I see that. It's about trying to think the best of people. And it not only helps whatever I would have, you know, thought about that person, but it really helps me because I'm relieved of that feeling, that anger inside. And this kind of leads to my next question, which is, there is so much misinformation, disinformation, whatever it is out there that is meant to inflame us, and it's meant to anger us, and it's meant to divide us, and it's meant to get us to hate the other side. And so I'm wondering, on the flip side of the biology of kindness, what does it look like when we don't practice regular kindness? And what can all of this angsty, stressy, hate-induced, you know, kind of things that are being presented to us do to us?
Well, we know that the stress response impacts your telomeres, impacts your biology, because I want to focus on the biology. And so we know that the anger, the fear, it activates this evolutionary system that was put in place to be used sparingly. It's important to be fearful, right? I use this analogy. If a bus is coming towards you, you need to be fearful and get out of the way, right? But the stress response is meant to help you survive, but it comes at a consequence, right? Because your heart rate goes up, sugar, glucose is metabolized, and everything that you need to get out of danger, but it's meant to be very short-lived. But you can imagine, if you're so angry or fearful or in a stress, overall stress, that acute system is on chronically. It's like the light is on all the time. You can't close your eyes because the light is on all the time. So this is a problem, because the stress response impacts, you know, it has there's a whole biological system. It leads to, you know, inflammation, which we know impacts directly telomere length. Okay, so there's a whole pathway there. So activation of the stress pathway is implicated in telomere attrition. So again, attrition, you know, accelerated shortening brings on early onset of chronic disease, cardiovascular, neural, again, what I've mentioned in the book, but just chronic disease. And so there's really no upside to being upset for long periods of time. It really isn't. Who does it help? No one.
No, we've all experienced what it is to be in a bad mood, and then all of a sudden everything else has gone to crap that day. Well, in reading about the book, in addition to reading the book, it says that this is the first in a trilogy of daily wellness tomes, if you will. What are the next two topics, and will you be directly involved with these, which we hope?
They've already been written. So we had too much to say for one book, and it wasn't even meant to, you know, squeeze out two books, because really, who has the time? But it turned out that there was other topics that we wanted to cover. So in Italian, the trilogy is, yes, there are two other books, and they are, again, they sort of focus on pro-social behaviors, consequences of pro-social behaviors. The second one deals with social justice, discrimination, racism, marginalization, because I've written a number of papers with colleagues on the impact of perceived racism, the social injustices, and then the third one also deals with pro-social behaviors and extension to climate change, because we sort of like move from the individual to the collective. And again, these books are sort of, they reflect my research, you know, and sort of people say, but you're a molecular biologist, in the lab, you've done mice manipulation with genes and, you know, where do you get off? You know, I get off in that I've been surrounded by brilliant people that I listen to and I observe and I have an open mind and I have questions and I'm curious and I've incorporated into a lot of my research and to the better of me, yes. To the better of me.
Well, we like it. We appreciate it. The book is The Biology of Kindness. It's 6 Daily Choices for Health, Well-Being, and Longevity. Immaculata DeVivo is our guest, and she has co-written this with meditation and mindfulness expert Daniel Lumera. And Immaculata, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. We love bringing this science into, you know, some different realms.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. And I want people to say that if you're kind to your DNA, your DNA will be kind to you.
Great. I love it. Thank you
very much for this opportunity. It was really delightful.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
When we think of science fiction, especially classic sci-fi writing, most of us, myself included, think of works from what has been called the Golden Age, circa 1935 to the early 1960s. But to find the true origins of benevolent and berserk robots, the dystopian society, the eco-catastrophe, and the unfathomable extraterrestrial, one needs to go further back in time, back to the early 1900s, back to an era that has been overshadowed by more recent science fiction, that is, until now. These stories, many over a century old, have found a new life through the Radium Age series from MIT Press. Here to tell us more about these writings and their implications for today's world is series editor Joshua Glenn. Joshua, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Katie and Lynn, for having me on.
So what was it about this era between 1900 and 1935 that spawned this new genre?
Well, yeah, so it's an incredibly vertiginous period in U.S. history, world history. And I use the word vertiginous because there's a really good history book called The Vertigo Years about precisely this era, the first three decades of the 20th century. But yes, incredible, you know, scientific and technological breakthroughs, including, you know, Marie Curie's discovery of radium and related discoveries about radioactivity and what that meant about the nature of the atom, the fundamental building block of the universe, was suddenly kind of thrown into question. It was no longer so as fundamental as we imagined. All these things were happening in that world, and they were leaking over in some ways into other genres. So people writing in the space of horror or romance or westerns and so forth were suddenly questioning, you know, the fundamental stability of things. And of course, in society, you had all kinds of amazing progressive movements for women and people of color, and colonies of empires were all fighting for rights of various kinds. And there was also backlashes against those things happening. So it was an incredibly topsy-turvy, you know, volatile moment. And so I think that this genre that didn't really get named until the 1920s, but was becoming into existence, you know, after H.G. Wells and Jules Verne in the early 20th century, was reacting and responding and, you know, predicting some of those topsy-turvy moments.
You talked briefly about Marie Curie, but why did you name this book, this series, The Radium Age? Where did that come from?
Yeah, originally when I was writing about this over 10 years ago now for a science fiction and science blog called IO9, I was just calling it the pre-Golden Age because we've all heard of the Golden Age, as you said, and B, there wasn't really a name for this earlier stuff. And in fact, as I started looking into it and reading histories of science fiction, I found that there was kind of a gap in the record where people thought that H.G. Wells and Jules Verne were these amazing, you know, pioneers of science fiction in the late 19th century. And they thought that the science fiction, developed by editor John Campbell and writers like Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein and so forth in the 1930s and 40s and 50s was really amazing and broke through to the mainstream and was really well written and smart. And then they just didn't want to talk about what had happened in between. And in fact, if you look back at writings by Asimov and others who were looking back at the stuff they grew up on in the 30s, they sort of said it was often childish and immature. They really wanted to, they're the ones who named it the golden age. The writers and editors from that moment, we didn't look back on it later and say, oh, that was the golden age. They said, we're in the golden age now. And they had to kind of build that up by dissing, if you will, the sort of what I call proto science fiction that was happening before that. So I wanted to eventually decided, I kind of got impatient with the idea that the golden age was a golden age, because in fact, it was in some ways worse than the radium age. John Campbell was quite sexist and racist, and they had very narrow ideas about what science fiction could be during that period. And also I just felt that it deserved a name because there was so much amazing material that I was finding as I was doing my research. So realizing that Marie Curie's, career sort of, she got the Nobel Prize right around 1900 for her discovery of radium, and then she died of radiation-induced leukemia in 1935. It just seemed like it was like a perfect kind of bookends to this period. So in kind of an honor of her and in honor of the fact that this is an era of turmoil and, things coming unstuck and people figuring out new ways to put them back together, it felt like radium was a nice metaphor for all that.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Josh Glenn. He is the series editor for the Radium Age book series by MIT Press. It's taking a look back at science fiction in the early 20th century from about 1900 to 1935. Is that right, Josh?
Yep.
Yeah. And so it's so interesting. I actually didn't know that's how Marie Curie died, but wow, what a metaphor for this book series. Can you give us an overview of the books that you have included in the series and a little bit about why the books got included or, why you sort of had to weed them out among others?
Yeah, thanks. So, there are hundreds of books published during this era. And they were, some of them were labeled science fiction at the time, others were not. And in weeding them out and figuring out which ones would be the best to put out there, at least in the first couple of years, we've only been doing this since 2022. I had a few things in mind. One, I wanted them to be like the best written books from this period, because I wanted to kind of put the lie to Isaac Asimov saying that, science fiction from before 1935 wasn't as good as what came later. So I wanted to show that like there's very talented writers, including some very famous writers like E.M. Forster, for example. We just published one of his stories, The Machine Stops, in a story collection this past year. Or Arthur Conan Doyle, Rudyard Kipling, all kinds of people that we know as, we know that they're good writers. We're doing science fiction as well. We also wanted to make sure that we were showing that it was quite diverse. And in fact, it was in some ways more diverse than Golden Age science fiction. So we're trying to focus on women writers. So we have Cicely Hamilton and Rose McCauley and Pauline Hopkins. I'm looking at my shelf here in front of me, Charlotte Haldane and others. We have a collection coming out from Frances Stevens, who was the first American woman writer to publish widely in the science fiction magazines coming out later this year. And we wanted to show that it was an international phenomenon. So we're trying to publish books that aren't just from England and America, although certainly a lot of them are the ones that we're publishing just because those are easiest for us since they're already in English. So we're actually translating. We just came out with a collection called The Inhumans and Other Stories, in which we had several stories written in Bengali or Bangla, the language of the Bengali area from the 1900s to 1930s, a collection of short science fiction stories from there that just came out on the 12th of this month, I think. And we have a novel coming from Russia from an author named Marietta Shaginian that's gonna come out next year. So it's really fun. It's wide ranging, and we're trying to kind of just to describe the tenor of the mixture of what we're trying to put out in the first few years. We're really trying to accomplish several things at once.
Mm. So when you talk about some of these international science fiction books that are coming out, were they ever translated into English back in the day? I'm assuming they weren't, and they're just being translated now.
Some were. So, for example, Karel Čapek, the Czechoslovakian author who gave us the word robot from his play RUR, which stands for Rossum's Universal Robots. Robot is comes from a Czech word meaning serf labor, forced labor, basically. And his book, it was a play and a sort of novel sort of at the same time, and it was a huge success in England and America. So then that book was translated. So there were certain books that were translated back in the day, but there are some that have never been translated. There's a lot of French science fiction that's never been translated from that era. So it's a lot of it's an adventure to find this stuff. Part of the problem for me is I can't read a lot of these languages, so I have to ask people who can read them. I'm sort of reaching out to scholars in other countries of science fiction and asking them to promote and give me ideas. So, for example, Bodhisattva Chattopadhyay from India, who lives in Finland, but he is the one who edited and translated this collection, The Inhumans, and I just had to trust him that he was choosing the best stories, and I believe that he did.
Well, these works, they reflect the time that they were written, talking about social upheaval, technological changes. But what can they tell us about society today, like 100 years later?
Yeah, so much. I mean, obviously, in a kind of big humanist sense, we haven't changed that much, right? So all our good qualities and our bad qualities are on display here. So, and I should mention that, it was quite a racist time period, right? And not that we aren't a racist time period still, but it was more, it was less frowned, much less frowned upon to sort of say racist things in mainstream novels. So that is one thing that we are kind of on the lookout for. And sometimes we have to really say, we're not going to publish anything by Rudyard Kipling or somebody because, he's just too, we just don't like his thinking anymore. But some of these other authors, we like enough about what they were doing to publish them, and we just have caveats, and we call out, moments where they're anti-Semitic or fascist or anti-Catholic or whatever it is that they're doing in the stories. So there's all of that going on. Then, of course, in terms of issues in science and so forth, yeah, some of those questions are, that were just speculation back then are kind of coming true today, right? So we just published Man's World, this novel by Charlotte Haldane, which was published originally in 1926. It came out earlier this month. And Charlotte Haldane was a very interesting figure, a kind of pioneering feminist journalist and writer, and like very brave, adventurous person. She ended up becoming like a war correspondent later. She married an eminent biologist named J.B.S. Haldane, one of the most famous scientists in England and popularizers of science at the time. And he was a eugenicist. He believed that in a kind of from a progressive angle, or so the thinking was at the time, that it would be helpful for human beings, so we would re be able to reduce pain and suffering and make life better if we encouraged only the right people, the right kinds of genes to reproduce, right? So there was a little bit of a progressive gloss on what really is quite an unprogressive idea. And she wrote this very strange novel, Man's World, which really predicts a lot of stuff that we'll read later in Brave New World by Aldous Huxley 10 years later. And in fact, she's the one who was asked to review his novel when it came out. And she imagines a future world in which men are in charge of things. The book's called Man's World. And women have two choices. They can either become mothers, and if they're going to become mothers, they kind of enter into a mother training academy, and they have to eat a certain way and think a certain way and live a certain way. And it's all in order to kind of induce or persuade their children to come out one gender or the other, which is sort of, was part of the scientific thinking at the time. And then the men are also sort of categorized into sort of, they can either be a soldier or a scientist or, a politician. Obviously, they have a lot more freedom and agency than the women. It sounds like a dystopia, right? However, it's very weird when you read it because she doesn't really present it as a dystopia. She's sort of the most of the characters in the book are keep making arguments for what a good idea this is. There is one of the main characters who's a young woman who rebels against her training to become a mother, and through some scientific jiggery pokery, she manages to sort of make herself seem infertile when she's not actually infertile, so she can have more freedom. But then by the end of the book, she changes her mind and wants to become a mother after all. So it's a strange book where Charlotte Haldane never really lets on the entire time what her position is. She's just sort of giving two sides of this story. And obviously, right, this stuff is very topical again right now. I mean, the FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine argument was just heard yesterday at the Supreme Court. So we're still very much talking about these questions around the politicization of medicine and, you know, of course, the Dobbs decision and all its consequences for, you know, women's right to choose is very much with us right now. And I don't know if we're any further along in our thinking as a society than we were when this book came out.
Yeah, you know, a lot of us think that The Handmaid's Tale might have been some of the first stories regarding this, but definitely not. How did you choose? I mean, there's going to be 16 books in the series. I think 14 of which are out now. That's a huge scope of work. How did you decide which authors to bring in? Because I was surprised to see even Jack London has a story in there. How did you filter all through all this great work?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me just say that there's going to be 16 by the end of this year, but that actually will be more down the road. I don't know how many we'll do eventually, but so we wanted to come out with the bangs. We did 7 the first year, which was a lot of work. And then we're slowing down a little bit now, doing 4 a year. We're up to 16 by the end of this year. To answer your question, so I'm a voracious reader. I read, you know, several novels a week. And for the last several years, all I've read is sort of books from 1930 and earlier. And I loved, you know, even before I got into this particular topic, I grew up reading all kinds of fun books from the 1930s, Dashiell Hammett, right? Or Dorothy Sayers, or The Mark of Zorro. You know, it's just a really, really fun period of adventure writing. And I just feel like the language is also really rich in those days. I feel like we've lost a lot of vocabulary since those days. So as someone who loves language, it's just really fun to read that stuff. So I basically got my hands on some good guides to, you know, thank goodness there's like scholars who have like done the heavy lifting of sort of finding all the work from this period and making lists of them. There's a really good book about early science fiction by a scholar named Everett E.F. Blyler that I've really heavily relied on. He's just somehow managed to read, looks like, hundreds and hundreds of books from this period. And I sort of would skim these lists and look for the ones that seemed interesting to me, and then track them down and read them. And sometimes I have to spend $60 or $70 to find these rare copies of them. Other times they're available online through Gutenberg, et cetera. But, you know, I read them all ahead of time. And yeah, the way to choose the authors, sometimes there are certain authors that I noticed from studying the history of science fiction who I just feel like it wouldn't be doing justice to in the sense that this is a history of science fiction if we didn't include certain authors because they were so important at the time. But then, as I mentioned earlier, I also want to make sure that we are showing that the fact that, you know, there's, for example, a lot of women were writing science fiction in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s. And that number actually decreased during the Golden Age because of people like John Campbell, who felt that women didn't have any business writing science fiction. And he also, there was this idea that science fiction needed to be what they call now hard science fiction, that needed to be very much about science and technology. And they had to eradicate all these other influences, which part of what's so fun about what I'm reading is that it's like a hodgepodge of influences within these books. Yes, there's some science and there's technology, but there's also occult ideas about telepathy, right? And astral projection. If you think about how John Carter gets to Mars in the Edgar Rice Burroughs book, it's through astral projection. These are ideas that weren't coming from science or technology. They were coming from, you know, occult and horror and fantasy writing. And they really, you know, someone like Samuel Delaney, the African-American science fiction author, who's of course incredibly important and beloved today, would try to write things for Campbell's magazines. And if you put in a Black protagonist, Campbell would say, we can't have a Black protagonist in the story. That's not believable. Things like that, you know? Whereas earlier you did have Black protagonists. We went strangely backwards in the Golden Age. I'm saying a lot of mean things about the Golden Age science fiction here. I like reading that stuff. Some of it's really entertaining and well-written. But I do feel that it was a moment that there's a very self-congratulatory rhetoric around that moment that is not entirely deserved because there were some negative things that were going on with that.
That, this is all so interesting. Okay, so Josh, if you're wanting to go back and, you know, start with one of these 16 books, or 14 now, but 16 by the end of the year, what interests me so much is it's kind of twofold. It's one, seeing the relative enlightenment of this time, as you're talking about, as it is communicated through science fiction. And two, I would be interested in knowing which book shows the most sort of genius in terms of predictability of what our future will hold for us. Can you recommend one or two to kind of, you know, both the enlightenment of that age and what most readily predicts what really happens in the future?
Yeah, that's always a fun question. Books that accurately predicted technology, the one that's most famous is not one of the ones that's in our series at the moment, but it's called Ralph 124C41 Plus by Hugo Gernsback, who is the first science fiction magazine editor. He published the first magazine devoted only to science fiction, and he named it science fiction, and the Hugo Awards are named after Hugo Gernsback. So he has a book where in this book, it has everything in it: fleece jackets and radar and video telephones and newspapers that stream into your brain while you sleep. I mean, we're not quite there yet, but that's the book of predicting the future. One of the books I like to talk about is, as far as like just being brilliant and enlightened, is called The Clockwork Man by E.V. Odell. E.V. Odell's a completely forgotten figure at this point. He was sort of on the outskirts of the Bloomsbury Group in England, you know, Virginia Woolf and these folks. And in this book, The Clockwork Man, it was sort of overshadowed by this RUR, this play I mentioned by Karel Čapek earlier, another robot book that came out the same year, unfortunately for him. But in The Clockwork Man, a sort of cyborg man from the future gets accidentally transported back to 1920s, and he's sort of a comical figure. And it turns out that what you eventually figure out is that because men were so bad at running things and were so warlike and, you know, just negative in so many ways, this other group of people, we don't know if they're aliens or if they're mutants or what they are, but at some point in the future, they decide that men can't really be in charge of things anymore. And what they do is they allow all the men to become these cyborg figures who live in kind of a perfect virtual reality all the time, where everything, all their wishes come true and they don't bother anybody. Meanwhile, women, who are fantastic, get to live in the normal world. And the cyborg men don't realize what a bad deal they got until this one guy comes back to the 1920s and realizes how nice it is in the real world. And he wishes that they had been, that men weren't such jerks. So to me, that's like, it's such a lovely story. And the other characters in the books are men and women who are having relationships with each other, and they are, you know, one of the relationships is much more loving and egalitarian. One of them is more standard, and, you know, the man wants to be the boss, and the woman's struggling to find her equality in that relationship. So it's this lovely kind of romance novel about how men and women should treat each other, with this amazing science fiction idea thrown in there as well. So I highly recommend that one. And my friend Annalie Newitz, the science fiction author of books like The Future of Another Timeline and Autonomous, and most recently Terraformers, wrote a really nice introduction to that one.
Well, this is going to be a great question for radio, but the cover design on all of these books is so incredibly eye-catching, a little art deco, a little futuristic. How did you, and we do, we all judge a book by its cover. I'm sure that was a very important choice. How did you decide on the cover art and what theme to go with?
Thank you for asking that, because I was just singing the praises to Seth, the artist who does all the covers, yesterday when he sent me the two new covers for the books that are coming out later this year. And I was saying, thank God for Seth. This series would be nothing without him. I agree with you. They are amazing. So Seth is a cartoonist from Canada who I've been a fan of for 30 years, probably, who is very, very influenced by cartoons and art from the 1920s and 30s and 40s, but he puts his own spin on it. So it feels contemporary and smart and interesting, but it also references that era. So it's not retro in a kind of cheesy way, if you see what I'm saying. And that's what I was kind of worried about going into the series with MIT Press, was that they would want these books to look really retro in a way that I don't like, you know what I mean? In kind of a fun, winky, you know, making fun of this stuff way, which you often see when books are reissued from the old days. And I said, I would love to work with Seth I think he's got the right, skills for the job, but we probably can't afford him. And Seth came down on his price, and MIT came up on their price, and we made it work out. And I've just been so, so pleased. And one other thing I want to say about Seth's art is that Seth, like me, is a real aficionado of, old comics magazines and science fiction magazines and stuff like that. And he's very tickled by this phenomenon. Maybe you guys are aware of this as well, that once upon a time, the cover art did not have to have anything to do with what was inside the book. It could be had to be generally, if it was about a dinosaur, there had to be a dinosaur on the cover, but it didn't have to be specifically really actually showing you what was happening in the story. It could be very fanciful. The whole idea was just to sell a copy of this book or this magazine. And that was kind of understood by the fans at the time. They weren't mad if they picked up a comic and it wasn't quite the story that was promised on the cover. And so Seth, we have a nice conversation before each book comes out, and I tell him what the plot is, and then he decides what he wants the illustration to be. And sometimes they're, he's put his own twist on it, which I love.
Well, his art and the collection of stories really does honor the stories, the works from back then. Well, our guest today has been Joshua Glenn. He is the series editor for The Radium Age, which is a series of science fiction works from 1900 and 1935. Really, really fascinating stories, and unfortunately, a lot of them are still timely. Well, Josh, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. You can hear our archived shows wherever you get your podcasts, KPCW Cool Science Radio, and also on our website, kpcw.org, under the Shows tab, Cool Science Radio. And we have a moment to talk about next week's show.
Next week's going to be fascinating. We will have an interview with the U of U Seismic Stations. They are seismic recording stations located all around the West, and in conjunction with the Great Utah Shakeout, which will be the 18th, I think.
Yes.
And we will have a fascinating conversation about the Chinese typewriter and the keyboard and the incredible science and efforts that went in to take a language that has over 56,000 characters and put them onto a small QWERTY keyboard.
It's a story most of us have never thought about, but interesting.